The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 1, Continued.
Cassette 1, Side 2. It is true of many that the outrage inflicted by arrest on their personal feelings and attachments can be far, far stronger than their political beliefs or their fear of prison. A person who is not inwardly prepared for the use of violence against him is always weaker than the person committing the violence. There are a few bright and daring individuals who understand instantly. Grigoryev, the director of the Geological Institute of the Academy of Sciences, barricaded himself inside and spent 2 hours burning up his papers when they came to arrest him in 1948. Sometimes the principal emotion of the person arrested is relief and even happiness. This is another aspect of human nature. It happened before the revolution, too. The Yekaterinoda schoolteacher, Sergio Kova, involved in the case of Alexander Ulyanov, felt only relief when she was arrested. But this feeling was 1,000 times stronger during epidemics of arrests, when all around you they were hauling in people like yourself and still had not come for you. For some reason, they were taking their time. After all, that kind of exhaustion, that kind of suffering, is worse than any kind of arrest, and not only for a person of limited courage. Vasily Vlasov, a fearless communist, whom we shall recall more than once later on, renounced the idea of escape proposed by his non-party assistants, and pined away because the entire leadership of the Kadi district was arrested in 1937, and they kept delaying and delaying his own arrest. He could only endure the blow head-on. He did endure it, and then he relaxed, and during the first days after his arrest, he felt marvelous. In 1934, the priest, Father Irakli, went to Alma-Ata to visit some believers in exile there. During his absence, they came 3 times to his Moscow apartment to arrest him. When he returned, members of his flock met him at the station and refused to let him go home, and for 8 years hid him in one apartment after another. The priest suffered so painfully from this harried life that when he was finally arrested in 1942, he sang hymns of praise to God. In this chapter, we are speaking only of the masses, the helpless rabbits arrested for no one knows what reason. But in this book, we will also have to touch on those who in post-revolutionary times remained genuinely political. Vera Rybakova, a social democratic student, dreamed when she was in freedom of being in the detention center in Sudstal. Only there did she hope to encounter her old comrades, for there were none of them left in freedom. And only there could she work out her world outlook. The socialist revolutionary, the SR, Yekaterina Olitskaya, didn't consider herself worthy of being imprisoned in 1924. After all, Russia's best people had served time and she was still young and had not yet done anything for Russia. But freedom itself was expelling her, and so both of them went to prison with pride and happiness. Resistance. Why didn't you resist? Today those who have continued to live on in comfort scold those who suffered. Yes, resistance should have begun right there, at the moment of the arrest itself. But it did not begin. And so they are leading you. During a daylight arrest, there is always that brief and unique moment when they are leading you, either inconspicuously on the basis of a cowardly deal you have made, or else quite openly, their pistols unholstered, through a crowd of hundreds of just such doomed innocents as yourself. You aren't gagged. You really can, and you really ought, to cry out that you are being arrested, that villains in disguise are trapping people, that arrests are being made on the strength of false denunciations, that millions are being subjected to silent reprisals. If many such outcries had been heard all over the city in the course of a day, would not our fellow citizens perhaps have begun to bristle, and would arrests perhaps no longer have been so easy? In 1927, when submissiveness had not yet softened our brains to such a degree, 2 Czechists tried to arrest a woman on Serpukhov Square during the day. She grabbed hold of the stanchion of a street lamp and began to scream, refusing to submit. A crowd gathered. There had to have been that kind of woman. There had to have been that kind of crowd, too. Passers-by didn't all just close their eyes and hurry by. The quick young men immediately became flustered. They can't work in the public eye. They got into their car and fled. Right then and there, she should have gone to a railroad station and left. But she went home to spend the night. And during the night, they took her off to the Lubyanka. Instead, not one sound comes from your parched lips, and that passing crowd naively believes that you and your executioners are friends out for a stroll. I myself often had the chance to cry out. On the 11th day after my arrest, 3 smirch bums, more burdened by 4 suitcases full of war booty than by me, they had come to rely on me in the course of the long trip, brought me to the Byelorussian station in Moscow. They were called a special convoy, in other words, a special escort guard, but in actual fact, their automatic pistols only interfered with their dragging along the 4 terribly heavy bags of loot they and their chiefs in Smirsch, counterintelligence on the 2nd Byelorussian front, had plundered in Germany, and were now bringing to their families in the fatherland under the pretext of convoying me. I myself lugged a 5th suitcase with no great joy, since it contained my diaries and literary works, which were being used as evidence against me. Not one of the 3 knew the city, and it was up to me to pick the shortest route to the prison. I had personally to conduct them to the Lubyanka, where they had never been before, and which, in fact, I confused with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I had spent one day in the counterintelligence prison at Army headquarters, and 3 days in the counterintelligence prison at the headquarters of the front, where my cellmates had educated me in the deceptions practiced by the interrogators, their threats and beatings, in the fact that once a person was arrested, he was never released, and in the inevitability of a tenere, a 10-year sentence. And then, by a miracle, I had suddenly burst out of there and for 4 days had travelled like a free person among free people, even though my flanks had already lain on rotten straw beside the latrine bucket, my eyes had already beheld beaten up and sleepless men, my ears had heard the truth, and my mouth had tasted prison gruel. So why did I keep silent? Why, in my last minute out in the open, did I not attempt to enlighten the hoodwinked crowd? I kept silent, too, in the Polish city of Brodnica, but perhaps they didn't understand Russian there. I didn't call out one word on the streets of Bialystok, but maybe it wasn't a matter that concerned the Poles. I didn't utter a sound at the Volkovysk station, but there were very few people there. I walked along the Minsk station platform beside those same bandits, as if nothing at all were amiss, but the station was still a ruin. And now I was leading the Smirsch men through the circular upper concourse of the Byelorussian radial subway station on the Moscow Circle line, with its white-ceilinged dome and brilliant electric lights, and opposite us 2 parallel escalators thickly packed with Muscovites rising from below. It seemed as though they were all looking at me. They kept coming in an endless ribbon from down there, from the depths of ignorance, on and on beneath the gleaming dome, reaching toward me for at least one word of truth. So why did I keep silent? Every man always has handy a dozen glib little reasons why he is right not to sacrifice himself. Some still have hopes of a favorable outcome to their case, and are afraid to ruin their chances by an outcry. For, after all, we get no news from that other world, and we do not realize that from the very moment of arrest our fate has almost certainly been decided in the worst possible sense, and that we cannot make it any worse. Others have not yet attained the mature concept on which a shout of protest to the crowd must be based. Indeed, only a revolutionary has slogans on his lips that are crying to be uttered aloud, and where would the uninvolved, peaceable, average man come by such slogans? He simply does not know what to shout. And then, last of all, there is a person whose heart is too full of emotion, whose eyes have seen too much for that whole ocean to pour forth in a few disconnected cries. As for me, I kept silent for one further reason. Because those Muscovites thronging the steps of the escalators were too few for me. Too few. Here my cry would be heard by 200 or twice 200. But what about the 200 million? Vaguely, unclearly, I had a vision that some day I would cry out to the 200 million. But for the time being, I did not open my mouth, and the escalator dragged me implacably down into the nether world. And when I got to Okhotny Riad, I continued to keep silent. nor did I utter a cry at the Metropole Hotel, nor wave my arms on the Golgotha of Lubyanka Square. Mine was probably the easiest imaginable kind of arrest. It did not tear me from the embrace of kith and kin, nor wrench me from a deeply cherished home life. One pallid European February, it took me from our narrow salient on the Baltic Sea, where, depending on one's point of view, either we had surrounded the Germans or they had surrounded us, and it deprived me only of my familiar artillery battery and the scenes of the last 3 months of the war. The brigade commander called me to his headquarters and asked me for my pistol. I turned it over without suspecting any evil intent, when suddenly from a tense, immobile suite of staff officers in the corner, two counterintelligence officers stepped forward hurriedly, crossed the room in a few quick bounds, their forehands grabbed simultaneously at the star on my cap, my shoulder boards, my officer's belt, my map case, and they shouted theatrically, "You are under arrest!" Burning and prickling from head to toe, all I could exclaim was, "Me? What for?" And even though there is usually no answer to this question, surprisingly I received one. This is worth recalling, because it is so contrary to our usual custom. Hardly had the Smirsch men finished plucking me and taken my notes on political subjects, along with my map case, and begun to push me as quickly as possible toward the exit, urged on by the German shell fire rattling the window panes, than I heard myself firmly addressed. Yes. Across the sheer gap separating me from those left behind, the gap created by the heavy falling word arrest, across that quarantine line not even a sound dared penetrate, came the unthinkable magic words of the brigade commander. "Solzhenitsyn, come back here." With a sharp turn, I broke away from the hands of the Smirsch men and stepped back to the brigade commander. I had never known him very well. He had never condescended to run-of-the-mill conversations with me. To me, his face had always conveyed an order, a command, wrath. But right now it was illuminated in a thoughtful way. Was it from shame for his own involuntary part in this dirty business? Was it from an impulse to rise above the pitiful subordination of a whole lifetime? 10 days before, I had led my own reconnaissance battery almost intact out of the fire pocket in which the 12 heavy guns of his artillery battalion had been left, and now he had to renounce me because of a piece of paper with a seal on it? "You have," he asked weightily, "a friend on the first Ukrainian front." "It's forbidden! You have no right!" the captain and the major of counterintelligence shouted at the colonel. In the corner, the suite of staff officers crowded closer to each other in fright, as if they feared to share the brigade commander's unbelievable rashness, the political officers among them already preparing to present materials against him. But I had already understood. I knew instantly I'd been arrested, because of my correspondence with a school friend, and understood from what direction to expect danger. Zakhar Georgievich Travkin could have stopped right there, but no. Continuing his attempt to expunge his part in this, and to stand erect before his own conscience, he rose from behind his desk, he had never stood up in my presence in my former life, and reached across the quarantine line that separated us, and gave me his hand, although he would never have reached out his hand to me had I remained a free man. And pressing my hand, while his whole suite stood there in mute horror, showing that warmth that may appear in an habitually severe face, he said fearlessly and precisely, "I wish you happiness, Captain." Not only was I no longer a captain, but I had been exposed as an enemy of the people, for among us every person is totally exposed from the moment of arrest. And he had wished happiness to an enemy? Here is what is most surprising of all. One can be a human being despite everything. Nothing happened to Travkin. Not long ago we met again, cordially, and I really got to know him for the first time. He is a retired general and an inspector of the Hunters Alliance. The panes rattled. The German shells tore up the earth 200 yards away, reminding one that this could not have happened back in the rear, under the ordinary circumstances of established existence, but only out here, under the breath of death, which was not only close by, but in the face of which all were equal. This is not going to be a volume of memoirs about my own life. Therefore, I am not going to recount the truly amusing details of my arrest, which was like no other. That night, the Smersh officers gave up their last hope of being able to make out where we were on the map. They never had been able to read maps anyway. So they politely handed the map to me and asked me to tell the driver how to proceed to counterintelligence at Army headquarters. I, therefore, led them and myself to that prison. And in gratitude, they immediately put me not in an ordinary cell, but in a punishment cell. And I really must describe that closet in a German peasant house which served as a temporary punishment cell. It was the length of one human body, and wide enough for three to lie packed tightly, four to pinch. As it happened, I was the fourth, shoved in after midnight. The three lying there blinked sleepily at me in the light of the smoky kerosene lantern, and moved over, giving me enough space to lie on my side, half between them, half on top of them, until gradually, by sheer weight, I could wedge my way in. And so four overcoats lay on the crushed, straw-covered floor, with eight boots pointing at the door. They slept, and I burned. The more self-assured I had been as a captain half a day before, the more painful it was to crowd onto the floor of that closet. Once or twice the other fellows woke up numb on one side, and we all turned over at the same time. Toward morning they awoke, yawned, grunted, pulled up their legs, moved into various corners, and our acquaintance began. "What are you in for?" But a troubled little breeze of caution had already breathed on me beneath the poisoned roof of Smersh, and I pretended to be surprised. "No idea. Do the bastards tell you?" However, my cellmates, tank men in soft black helmets, hid nothing. They were three honest, open-hearted soldiers, people of a kind I had become attached to during the war years because I myself was more complex and worse. All three had been officers. Their shoulder boards also had been viciously torn off, and in some places the cotton batting stuck out. On their stained field shirts, light patches indicated where decorations had been removed, and there were dark and red scars on their faces and arms, the results of wounds and burns. Their tank unit had, unfortunately, arrived for repairs in the village where the Smersh counterintelligence headquarters of the 48th Army was located. Still damp from the battle of the day before, yesterday they had gotten drunk, and on the outskirts of the village broke into a bath where they had noticed two raunchy broads going to bathe. The girls, half-dressed, managed to get away all right from the soldiers' staggering, drunken legs. But one of them, it turned out, was the property of the Army Chief of Counterintelligence, no less. Yes, for 3 weeks the war had been going on inside Germany, and all of us knew very well that if the girls were German, they could be raped and then shot. This was almost a combat distinction. Had they been Polish girls, or our own displaced Russian girls, they could have been chased naked around the garden and slapped on the behind, an amusement no more. But just because this one was the campaign wife of the Chief of Counterintelligence, right off some deep-in-the-rear sergeant had viciously torn from three frontline officers the shoulder boards awarded them by the front headquarters, and had taken off the decorations conferred upon them by the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet. And now these warriors, who had gone through the whole war, and who had, no doubt, crushed more than one line of enemy trenches, were waiting for a court-martial, whose members, had it not been for their tank, could have come nowhere near the village. We put out the kerosene lamp, which had already used up all the air there was to breathe. A Judas hole, the size of a postage stamp, had been cut in the door, and through it came indirect light from the corridor. Then, as if afraid that with the coming of daylight we would have too much room in the punishment cell, they tossed in a fifth person. He stepped in wearing a newish Red Army tunic and a cap that was also new, and when he stopped opposite the peephole we could see a fresh face with a turned-up nose and red cheeks. "Where are you from, brother? Who are you?" "From the other side," he answered briskly. "A spy." "You're kidding." We were astounded. To be a spy and to admit it, Scheinin and the brothers Tour had never written that kind of spy story. "What is there to kid about in wartime?" the young fellow sighed reasonably. "And just how else can you get back home from being a POW? Well, you tell me.
He had barely begun to tell us how, some days back, the Germans had led him through the front lines so that he could play the spy and blow up bridges, whereupon he had gone immediately to the nearest battalion headquarters to turn himself in. But the weary, sleep-starved battalion commander hadn't believed his story about being a spy and had sent him off to the nurse to get a pill. And at that moment, new impressions burst upon us.
"Out for toilet call! Hands behind your backs!"
hollered a master sergeant hardhead as the door sprang open. He was just built for swinging the tail of a 122mm cannon. A circle of machine gunners had been strung around the peasant courtyard, guarding the path which was pointed out to us, and which went behind the barn. I was bursting with indignation that some ignoramus of a master sergeant dared to give orders to us officers.
"Hands behind your backs!"
But the tank officers put their hands behind them, and I followed suit. Back of the barn was a small, square area in which the snow had been all trampled down, but had not yet melted. It was soiled all over with human feces, so densely scattered over the whole square that it was difficult to find a spot to place one's 2 feet and squat. However, we spread ourselves about, and the five of us did squat down. Two machine gunners grimly pointed their machine pistols at us as we squatted, and before a minute had passed, the master sergeant brusquely urged us on.
"Come on, hurry it up. With us they do it quickly."
Not far from me squatted one of the tank men, a native of Rostov, a tall, melancholy senior lieutenant. His face was blackened by a thin film of metallic dust or smoke, but the big red scar stretching across his cheek stood out nonetheless.
"What do you mean, with us?"
he asked quietly, indicating no intention of hurrying back to the punishment cell that still stank of kerosene.
"In Smersh counterintelligence,"
the master sergeant shot back proudly and more resonantly than was called for. The counterintelligence men used to love that tastelessly concocted word Smersh, manufactured from the initial syllables of the words for death to spies. They felt it intimidated people.
"And with us, we do it slowly," replied the senior lieutenant thoughtfully.
His helmet was pulled back, uncovering his still untrimmed hair. His oaken, battle-hardened rear end was lifted toward the pleasant, coolish breeze.
"Where do you mean, with us?"
the master sergeant barked at him more loudly than he needed to.
"In the Red Army,"
the senior lieutenant replied very quietly from his heels, measuring with his look the cannon tailor that never was. Such were my first gulps of prison air. Chapter 2. The History of Our Sewage Disposal System. When people today decry the abuses of the cult, they keep getting hung up on those years which are stuck in our throats, 37 and 38. And memory begins to make it seem as though arrests were never made before or after, but only in those 2 years. Although I have no statistics at hand, I am not afraid of erring when I say that the wave of 1937 and 1938 was neither the only one nor even the main one, but only one, perhaps, of the three biggest waves which strained the murky, stinking pipes of our prison sewers to bursting. Before it came the wave of 1929 and 1930, the size of a good river Ob, which drove a mere 15 million peasants, maybe even more, out into the taiga and the tundra. But peasants are a silent people without a literary voice, nor do they write complaints or memoirs. No interrogators sweated out the night with them, nor did they bother to draw up formal indictments. It was enough to have a decree from the village Soviet. This wave poured forth, sank down into the permafrost, and even our most active minds recall hardly a thing about it. It is as if it had not even scarred the Russian conscience. And yet Stalin, and you and I as well, committed no crime more heinous than this. And after it, there was the wave of 1944 to 1946, the size of a good Yenisei, when they dumped whole nations down the sewer pipes, not to mention millions and millions of others who, because of us, had been prisoners of war, carried off to Germany, and subsequently repatriated. This was Stalin's method of cauterizing the wounds, so that scar tissue would form more quickly, and thus the body politic as a whole would not have to rest up, catch its breath, regain its strength. But in this wave, too, the people were of the simpler kind, and they wrote no memoirs. But the wave of 1937 swept up and carried off to the archipelago people of position, people with a party past. Yes, educated people, around whom were many who had been wounded and remained in the cities. And what a lot of them had pen in hand. And today they are all writing, speaking, remembering. 1937. A whole Volga of the people's grief. But just say 1937 to a Crimean Tatar, a Kalmyk, a Chechen, and he'll shrug his shoulders. And what's 1937 to Leningrad when 1935 had come before it? And for the second-termers, that is, repeaters, or people from the Baltic countries, weren't 1948 and 1949 harder on them? And if sticklers for style and geography should accuse me of having omitted some Russian rivers, and of not yet having named some of the waves, then just give me enough paper. There were enough waves to use up the names of all the rivers in Russia. It is well known that any organ withers away if it is not used. Therefore, if we know that the Soviet security organs, or organs, and they christened themselves with this vile word, praised and exalted above all living things, have not died off even to the extent of one single tentacle, but instead have grown new ones and strengthened their muscles, it is easy to deduce that they have had constant exercise. Through the sewer pipes, the flow pulsed. Sometimes the pressure was higher than had been projected, sometimes lower. But the prison sewers were never empty. The blood, the sweat, and the urine into which we were pulped, pulsed through them continuously. The history of this sewage system is the history of an endless swallow and flow, flood alternating with ebb, and ebb again with flood. Waves pouring in, some big, some small. Brooks and rivulets flowing in from all sides. Trickles oozing in through gutters. And then just plain, individually scooped up droplets. The chronological list which follows, in which waves made up of millions of arrested persons are given equal attention with ordinary streamlets of unremarkable handfuls, is quite incomplete, meagre, miserly, and limited by my own capacity to penetrate the past. What is really needed is a great deal of additional work by survivors familiar with the material. In compiling this list, the most difficult thing is to begin, partly because the further back into the decades one goes, the fewer the eyewitnesses who are left, and therefore the light of common knowledge has gone out and darkness has set in, and the written chronicles either do not exist or are kept under lock and key. Also, it is not entirely fair to consider in a single category the especially brutal years of the Civil War and the first years of peacetime, when mercy might have been expected. But even before there was any civil war, it could be seen that Russia, due to the makeup of its population, was obviously not suited for any sort of socialism whatsoever. It was totally polluted. One of the first blows of the dictatorship was directed against the cadets, the members of the Constitutional Democratic Party. Under the Tsar, they had constituted the most dangerous ranks of revolution, and under the government of the proletariat, they represented the most dangerous ranks of reaction. At the end of November 1917, on the occasion of the first scheduled convening of the Constituent Assembly, which did not take place, the Cadet Party was outlawed and arrests of its members began. At about the same time, people associated with the Alliance for the Constituent Assembly and the students enrolled in the soldiers' universities were being thrown in the jug. Knowing the sense and spirit of the revolution, it is easy to guess that during these months such central prisons as Kresty in Petrograd and the Butyrki in Moscow, and many provincial prisons like them, were filled with wealthy men, prominent public figures, generals and officers, as well as officials of ministries and of the state apparatus who refused to carry out the orders of the new authority. One of the first operations of the Cheka was to arrest the entire committee of the All-Russian Union of Employees. One of the first circulars of the NKVD in December 1917 stated, "In view of sabotage by officials, use maximum initiative in localities, not excluding confiscations, compulsion, and arrests." Vestnik, NKVD, NKVD Herald, 1917, number 1, page 4. And even though V.I. Lenin, at the end of 1917, in order to establish strict revolutionary order,
demanded merciless suppression of attempts at anarchy on the part of drunkards, hooligans, counter-revolutionaries, and other persons. Lenin, Sobranye Sochinenia, Collected Works, 5th edition, volume 35, page 68. In other words, foresaw that drunkards and hooligans represented the principal danger to the October Revolution, with counter-revolutionaries somewhere back in third place, he nonetheless put the problem more broadly. In his essay, How to Organize the Competition, January the 7th and 10th, 1918, V. I. Lenin proclaimed the common united purpose of purging the Russian land of all kinds of harmful insects. And under the term insects, he included not only all class enemies, but also workers malingering at their work. For example, the typesetters of the Petrograd party printing shops. That is what time does. It is difficult for us nowadays to understand how workers who had just become dictators were immediately inclined to malinger at work they were doing for themselves. And then again, in what block of a big city, in what factory, in what village, are there not saboteurs who call themselves intellectuals? True, the forms of insect purging which Lenin conceived of in this essay were most varied. In some places they would be placed under arrest, in other places set to cleaning latrines. In some, after having served their time in punishment cells, they would be handed yellow tickets. In others, parasites would be shot. Elsewhere, you could take your pick of imprisonment, or punishment at forced labor of the hardest kind. Even though he perceived and suggested the basic directions punishment should take, Vladimir Ilyich proposed that communes and communities should compete to find the best methods of purging. It is not possible for us at this time fully to investigate exactly who fell within the broad definition of insects. The population of Russia was too heterogeneous and encompassed small, special groups, entirely superfluous and today forgotten. The people in the local zemsts, for self-governing bodies in the provinces, were, of course, insects. People in the cooperative movements were also insects, as were all owners of their own homes. There were not a few insects among the teachers in the gymnasiums. The church parish councils were made up almost exclusively of insects, and it was insects, of course, who sang in church choirs. All priests were insects, and monks and nuns even more so. And all those Tolstoyans who, when they undertook to serve the Soviet government on, for example, the railroads, refused to sign the required oath to defend the Soviet government with gun in hand, thereby showed themselves to be insects too. We will later see some of them on trial. The railroads were particularly important, for there were indeed many insects hidden beneath railroad uniforms, and they had to be rooted out, and some of them slapped down. And telegraphers, for some reason, were, for the most part, inveterate insects who had no sympathy for the Soviets. Nor could you say a good word about Vikzhel, the All-Russian Executive Committee of the Union of Railroad Workers, nor about the other trade unions, which were often filled with insects hostile to the working class. Just those groups we have so far enumerated represent an enormous number of people, several years' worth of purge activity. In addition, how many kinds of cursed intellectuals there were, restless students and a variety of eccentrics, truth-seekers, and holy fools, of whom even Peter the Great had tried in vain to purge Russia, and who were always a hindrance to a well-ordered, strict regime. It would have been impossible to carry out this hygienic purging, especially under wartime conditions, if they had had to follow outdated legal processes and normal judicial procedures. And so an entirely new form was adopted, extrajudicial reprisal. And this thankless job was self-sacrificingly assumed by the Cheka, the sentinel of the revolution, which was the only punitive organ in human history that combined in one set of hands investigation, arrest, interrogation, prosecution, trial, and execution of the verdict. In 1918, in order to speed up the cultural victory of the revolution as well, they began to ransack the churches and throw out the relics of saints and to carry off church plate. Popular disorders broke out in defense of the plundered churches and monasteries. Here and there the alarm bells rang out, and the true Orthodox believers rushed forth, some of them with clubs. Naturally, some had to be expended right on the spot, and others arrested. In considering now the period from 1918 to 1920, we are in difficulties. Should we classify among the prison waves all those who were done in before they even got to prison cells? And in what classification should we put those whom the committees of the poor took behind the wing of the village Soviet or to the rear of the courtyard and finished off right there? Did the participants in the cluster of plots uncovered in every province, two in Ryazan, one in Kostroma, Vishnevolchek and Velizh, several in Kiev, several in Moscow, one in Saratov, Chernigov, Astrakhan, Seliger, Smolensk, Bobruisk, the Tambov Cavalry, Chembar, Velikiye Luki, Mstislavl, etc., at least succeed in setting foot on the land of the archipelago, or did they not, and are they therefore not related to the subject of our investigations? Bypassing the repression of the now famous rebellions, Yaroslavl, Murom, Rybinsk, Arzamas, we know of certain events only by their names, for instance, the Kolpino executions of June 1918. What were they? Who were they? And where should they be classified? There is also no little difficulty in deciding whether we should classify among the prison waves or on the balance sheets of the Civil War those tens of thousands of hostages, that is, people not personally accused of anything, those peaceful citizens not even listed by name, who were taken off and destroyed simply to terrorize or wreak vengeance on a military enemy or a rebellious population. After August the 30th, 1918, the NKVD ordered the localities to arrest immediately all right socialist revolutionaries and to take a significant number of hostages from the bourgeoisie and military officers. This was just as if, for example, after the attempt of Alexander Ulyanov's group to assassinate the Tsar, not only its members, but all the students in Russia and a significant number of Zemstvo officials had been arrested. By a decree of the Defense Council of February the 15th, 1919, apparently with Lenin in the chair, the Cheka and the NKVD were ordered to take hostage peasants from those localities where the removal of snow from railroad tracks was not proceeding satisfactorily. And if the snow removal did not take place, they were to be shot. Dekreti Sovetskoy Vlasti, Decrees of the Soviet Regime, Volume 4, Moscow, 1968, page 627. At the end of 1920, by decree of the Council of People's Commissars, permission was given to take Social Democrats as hostages too. But even restricting ourselves to ordinary arrests, we can note that by the spring of 1918, a torrent of socialist traitors had already begun that was to continue without slackening for many years. All these parties, the SRs, the Mensheviks, the anarchists, the popular socialists, had for decades only pretended to be revolutionaries. They had worn socialism only as a mask, and for that they went to hard labor, still pretending. Only during the violent course of the revolution was the bourgeois essence of these socialist traitors discovered. What could be more natural than to begin arresting them? Soon after the outlawing of the cadets, the dispersal of the Constituent Assembly, the disarming of the Preobrazhensky and other regiments, they began in a small way to arrest, quietly at first, both SRs and Mensheviks. After June the 14th, 1918, the day members of these parties were excluded from all the Soviets, the arrests proceeded in a more intensive and more coordinated fashion. From July the 6th on, they began to deal with the left SRs in the same way, though the left SRs had been cleverer and had gone on pretending longer that they were allies of the one and only consistent party of the proletariat. From then on, it was enough for a workers' protest, a disturbance, a strike, to occur at any factory or in any little town, and there were many of them in the summer of 1918, and in March 1921 they shook Petrograd, Moscow, and then Kronstadt, and forced the inauguration of the NEP. And, coinciding with concessions, assurances, and the satisfaction for the just demands of the workers, the Cheka began silently to pick up Mensheviks and SRs at night as being the people truly to blame for these disorders. In the summer of 1918, and in April and October of 1919, they jailed anarchists right and left.
This book is continued on cassette 2, side 1.